From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. President Biden is making changes to the Paycheck Protection Program, also known as PPP. PPP started last year during the pandemic and gave forgivable loans to some businesses that keep workers on the payroll. But the relief was uneven at best, and many businesses owned by women and people of color were locked out. Their businesses were too small to qualify. President Biden's new rules seeks to address those problems. Chiavelli Carazana is an economy reporter with The 19th, a nonprofit newsroom focused on the intersection of gender, politics, and policy. She's been following the story, and she joins us now from Orlando, Florida. Welcome. Nice to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So President Biden's changes include a new 2-week period when only the smallest businesses will be able to apply, and that opens tomorrow. Tell us who qualifies and how this all works.
Yeah, so this set of new rules is really going to change who can qualify for this last bit of aid, right? So we got some $284 billion for the PPP program in December. About half of that has been dispersed, and this is the second half that is left. And so part of that is to focus on the smallest businesses. So beginning in this window that opens on Wednesday, businesses with fewer than 20 employees will be the only ones that will be allowed to sign up for loans. And the Biden administration wants to encourage banks to really look out for these smaller businesses and ensure that they are signing them up for the program. And now that window is going to last until March 9th, when it will close at 5 p.m.
So explain why focusing on these small businesses is such an important issue of equity.
Yeah, I feel like the story of this past year has been looking at just sort of the inequitable release of a lot of these programs. When PPP was first enacted in March of 2020, the funds ran out so quickly, right? The first round, I think, ran out in like 2 weeks. And a lot of businesses that had existing banking relationships were the ones that were able to be first in line to get those funds. And what happened was people of color, women-owned businesses, those businesses did not have those existing banking relationships to get in line quickly, to be able to process the loans quickly before the money disappeared. And so we started to see anecdotally at the beginning of last year that businesses that, like businesses held by women and people of color, were just not getting as much access to the funds because of sort of some of the structural issues that were already in place when PPP was rolled out.
So there are these new changes to the PPP application itself as well. Last year, applicants were initially not required to list their racial, gender, or veteran status, but those demographic questions will now be on the first page. Tell us what other changes people should expect.
Yeah, I think the demographic changes were really interesting because we were waiting to hear what the Biden administration, and that's my dog going, but the Biden administration was going to do specifically to ensure that they were gathering data on women and people of color. That was part of the problem, right? We didn't know exactly how many of them were shut out of these loans. So the application question that I asked about demographics was buried in the very last page of the PPP application. And so the response rates were minuscule. That has now, it's now on the first page, and that was a recent change from last week. And, you know, the response rates are still, you know, some 43% of people are reporting gender, only 26% are reporting race and ethnicity. So, you know, it's still really, really small compared to some benchmarks of 70 to 85% that they want to be hitting on that. Yeah. And I think that speaks to a lot of this inequity, right? You know, people don't want to say that they're a woman-owned business, that they're a business owned by a person of color, because there is this history of having trouble getting access to financial capital.
Yeah, understood. We've got about 45 seconds left. You've called the current economic situation America's first female recession. What do you think are the long-term consequences here if these economic disparities are not addressed?
We're looking at more than almost about half of the entire labor force has been affected in a way that is so deeply troubling this year. Whether you're a woman working in a hospitality industry or you're a woman owned business, you have been feeling it probably a little bit harder than everybody else. Yeah. What happens when half the population is affected so hard in the labor market? What happens long term to the gender pay gap, to women who want to rejoin the workforce?
These are hard questions that we have to answer. Yeah. No, you're exactly right. And I'm so grateful that you came here to talk about this. Chiavelli Carazana, economy reporter with the 19th. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Texas is getting back on its feet after the power grid failure that left millions of people without electricity for days in freezing temperatures. It's not the first time winter weather has shown how vulnerable the Texas grid is, and some experts saw this crisis coming. Ed Herz is one of them. He's an energy economist at the University of Houston. Ed, thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Peter.
And you've been predicting that a grid failure like the one Texas saw last week would happen. How did you see it coming?
Well, the incentives, the payoff matrix, the way the market was structured, it was pointed towards failure. And so we had a significant tragic preview of this in 2011. There were all sorts of hearings and recommendations for reliability. And of course, that was all shelved and nobody did anything. The way the Texas market was structured 20 years ago when they broke up the vertically integrated utilities, the net result of it all is the generators have not earned a return on capital. The revenues they've received are less than the cost of providing the electricity. So there's a disincentive to keep equipment ready. They don't get compensated to have equipment winterized. And the architect of the market says, well, it worked as designed. And well, if it was designed to fleece the consumer, also known as the voter, it did really well.
Yeah, and we'll see if there are repercussions at the ballot box eventually. But in the meantime, let's go back to 2011. That major winter storm, there were recommendations for changes that would have shored up the grid, that would have kept the power sources from freezing. Why wasn't the system fixed then? Why wasn't it weatherized?
I think the real answer goes to the political situation. No one wants to spend money in advance of a disaster. Every incumbent politician knows that if the price goes up at the pump or the price goes up at the electricity meter, they're not going to be reelected. And so I think that's the simple calculus. I know Governor Perry, former Secretary of Energy Perry, made a comment last week that, you know, Texans would be happy to go 4 days without power in order to avoid federal regulation. But, you know, those are pretty strong words, number one, for a guy who doesn't live in Texas anymore, and number two is not hooked up to a dialysis machine. What electricity's value is what it allows us to do. It allows us to carry on commerce, to work, to take care of ourselves. And without it, we see what the real value is. Paying an extra penny a kilowatt hour to have avoided the situation that we had last week, you know, certainly seems like it would have been cheap insurance.
Well, right, because now we see that the price at the electrical meter has gone up by a tremendous amount. Some people who did have power last week got bills for thousands and thousands of dollars, and they're wondering how they're going to pay them. The governor has said that utilities can't disconnect people for not paying. How do you think the government should handle that problem?
Well, you know, it's really interesting that a free market governor is sitting here imposing more regulations on a market that was designed to fail in this very fashion. Yeah, Peter, the bills are high, $40 billion changing hands, but the damage estimates are now over $50 billion. So the consumer has now paid double the damages when, an ordinary bill last week would have been about 4 cents a kilowatt hour wholesale instead of $9 a kilowatt hour wholesale. You know, they're tens of thousands of dollars plus the tens of thousands of dollars you have to pay to repair your pipes, to repair your homes, to replace your furniture. And that's for folks who had a relatively easy outcome.
Should the state consider giving up its independent grid and join the national power system instead?
No, I don't think that would have been a solution. We lost over 40% of our generation capacity because they weren't ready for winter. The natural gas facilities, the coal facilities, the instability tripped off a nuclear plant. Everybody went down because they just weren't ready for the weather event, which was something everyone knew was a possibility. Tying this into the national grid, heck, we might have taken down the rest of the grid as well. And, this polar vortex had an impact across much of the nation, you know, there was no extra power that Texas could have drawn on.
Right. So what's the solution? I mean, the last week's power grid failure led to a water crisis, burst pipes, loss of business, 58 deaths. How do you make sure it doesn't happen again then?
Well, we're going to have to pay the generators to be ready at any point that we have a supply tightness or market tightness. You know, right now, the generators are not paid to be winterized, and there's no enforcement mechanism. They can't be penalized. They can't be fined. They can't be thrown off the grid. There are no teeth. The grid manager is essentially the air traffic controller of electrons across the grid. They don't make investments. They just kind of shunt traffic around. The Public Utility Commission has essentially been missing in action for more than a decade. There's little oversight, there's no accountability, and obviously no one's taking responsibility.
Ed Hertz, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Thirty years ago today, President George H.W. Bush announced the start of the ground war in Operation Desert Storm.
I ask only that all of you stop what you were doing and say a prayer for all the coalition forces, and especially for our men and women in uniform, who this very moment are risking their lives for their country and for all of us.
The two-month-long war ended Iraq's occupation of Kuwait. 154 Americans died in combat, but more than 100,000 American veterans of Operation Desert Storm came home with wounds you couldn't really see. Constant pain, fatigue, stomach, memory, and neurological issues. This is now known as Gulf War illness, and a congressionally mandated committee that investigated says it was triggered by pesticides and medication that U.S. troops were ordered to take to protect them against nerve gas. Jim Binns chaired that committee for 12 years. He's a Vietnam veteran, and he joins us now. Jim, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sure. And we're also joined by Anthony Hardy, a veteran who suffers from Gulf War illness. Anthony, it's good to speak with you.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And let's start with you. You were in the Army, part of the ground campaign in Kuwait, and you say that your health problems started during that deployment and have never really gotten better. Describe what happened to you.
Yes, that's correct. Going through an Iraqi bunker complex, there was the characteristic odors of chemical warfare agents. Also, we took the pyridostigmine bromide anti-nerve agent pills, and those made about two-thirds of my team sick to varying levels. But my respiratory and fatigue issues, chronic diarrhea, all began while in the Gulf and never subsided.
Wow. Yeah. And did you think at the time that your health issues were connected to either those pills that you were ordered to take or to the pesticides that were being used? I mean, did you make the connection at the time?
I did not make the connection to the pesticides. I did make a connection to the pills. It was pretty obvious when we took them that we were getting sick from them. But not everyone got sick from them, but many of us did. And then also going through that particular bunker complex, I didn't make the connection immediately. But my chronic cough and coughing up what looked like pieces of lung tissue were pretty self-evident.
Did anybody complain at the time? Did you bring this up with anyone?
Yes. I sought medical treatment from our team medic, but, you know, it was wartime conditions. We were, the war was over at that point. We were in Kuwait City, and there was very limited medical attention. And it sounds like my situation was also pretty typical for a lot of Gulf War troops who we experienced symptoms while they're still on the ground, came home with health issues, complained about them or didn't, but they simply just never went away.
Yeah. 30 years on, how are you now? Still the same symptoms?
Yes, that's correct. I've medically retired more than a decade ago and continue to have a pretty debilitating health issues.
What kind of drain does that cause on your life?
Well, it's extremely challenging. I've gotten involved on advocacy issues on behalf of other veterans as well, because there are so many veterans who are suffering. And unfortunately, VA continues to deny most Gulf War veterans' claims. We have a little saying about that. Delay, deny, wait until we die before they're approved. Mm-hmm. So that's been one of the biggest challenges.
Well, I'm sure that's very frustrating. Now, so are you saying that when you go to the VA and you say, well, this is connected to my service, They say what?
Going to the VA for health care is one issue, and I've been getting better health care in recent years, but a lot of Gulf War veterans that I hear from in my advocacy role with Veterans for Common Sense do not have that same experience and are still told this long after the war that it's all on their heads.
Let's bring in Jim Binns. So we hear this story from Anthony. He says he's not alone. There's hundreds or thousands of people just like him who are sort of being ignored. These symptoms are not being acknowledged by the federal government, by the VA. Jim, do you agree? Is this a common story as we mark the 30th anniversary of Desert Storm?
Yes, entirely. Unfortunately, Anthony's experience is typical of the veterans that we have met over the past 30 years. I became involved in this about 20 years ago because Congress was unhappy with the fact that the federal government was doing so little for these veterans who clearly had come home with major health problems. And it passed a law that created a committee to be appointed by the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, which I chaired for 12 years. I began with a lot of optimism that it was just a matter of pointing out what the research showed, that these people were in fact sick and what had caused it, and that the focus could move toward trying to find treatments. And instead, what we discovered was that the focus of government research efforts was to cover up the problem. For example, the VA does a major survey every 10 years of Gulf War veterans' health. And in that survey, most recently, they included page after page of questions about psychological problems, and no questions whatsoever about the symptoms Anthony has just mentioned. And it's really a continuation of the story that began with Agent Orange in Vietnam. Toxic wounds have, in all the recent wars, the wars of our memory, been the major health problem. More veterans suffer from them than from exposure to bombs and bullets. And the government consistently has refused to recognize these problems. They deny today 80% of Gulf War claims and burn pits claims.
And I'm trying to understand why. Is it a matter of money? I mean, certainly the federal government can find money to pay for the treatment of these veterans, or is it just something else entirely?
It's money is a big part of it. We have statements from senior VA officials that they do not even want to use the term Gulf War illness because it might imply a connection between poor health and the Gulf. So money is a great deal of the problem. Part of it is being executed by the same people. The people who initially denied that Agent Orange caused health problems are in many cases the same people who denied Gulf War issues and who today are denying that veterans who were exposed to burn pits in Afghanistan and Iraq suffer from health problems as a result.
Well, we do have a new president, and Joe Biden has even said that he thinks the death of his son Beau to brain cancer is a result of his exposure to burn pits during his service in Iraq. Here's Biden in 2019.
He volunteered. He joined the National Guard at age 32 because he thought he had an obligation to go. He spent a year in Iraq. He came back decorated. And because of his exposure to burn pits, in my view, I can't prove it yet, he came back with stage 4 glioblastoma. 18 months he lived knowing that he was going to die. Nobody makes it.
And the military uses burn pits to get rid of human waste and other trash in war zones. But when you hear that from the president, does it bode well for your cause?
I certainly hope so. The one message, if I were in the role I used to play advising the government today, the one message I would try to get to the president is that he is correct. The government officials who are saying that the research does not show a connection between burn pits and ill health, these are the same people working from the same playbook who have denied that Gulf War illness is connected to toxic exposures, who denied that Agent Orange was due to toxic exposures. If he will commission a thorough review at the White House level, so it's not dependent upon these people in the bureaucracy. That's what he will discover, and he will also discover that there are positive things that can be done, not just paying benefits, which needs to be done too, but also research that can improve the health of many of these veterans. Unfortunately, Bo would not have been one of them. I mean, glioblastoma is a death sentence. But there are many symptoms, such as the ones Anthony has described, that can be improved with the right research. And it would be such a positive step for the government to take to become advocates and helpers of these heroes who have given their lives to their country, but their country refuses to care for them.
Well, Anthony Hardy, I want to bring you back in here. Gulf War vet, still suffering illness 30 years after the fact. Tell me from that perspective how you're feeling.
Well, it's pretty difficult. It makes every aspect of living difficult. There are days when I have better days, and I count them by having some good hours on certain days. Other days are very difficult. After we get done with this interview, I'm going to go back to bed, and we'll probably spend most of the day there. So it's pretty challenging, and I'm certainly not alone. There are as many as a third of us Gulf War veterans from the 91 Gulf War and countless others with other toxic exposures from burn pits that need to be taken care of, both with effective treatments on the healthcare side, but also approving their continually denied disability claims so that they can have some sort of adequate subsistence while they're battling these health issues.
Anthony Hardy, veteran of the 1991 Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm. We've also been speaking with Jim Binns, a Vietnam War vet and an advocate for those who have suffered toxic wounds at war. Thanks to you both. I do appreciate the time today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again for your interest.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
In recent mass shootings, people have been targeted for who they are or who they worship. But on June 28, 2018, people were targeted for the job they do at a newspaper. Listen to the new series from NPR's Embedded about the survivors at the Capital Gazette.
The value of Bitcoin was soaring this month in the markets. But in recent days, Bitcoin's value has stumbled. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen was asked about cryptocurrency at a conference yesterday.
You know, I think people should beware. It can be extremely volatile. And, you know, I do worry about potential losses.
For more on Bitcoin and how to invest in it, if you're willing to roll the dice, we're joined by Jill Schlesinger. She's CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, nice to speak with you again.
Great to be with you.
A lot has happened in the Bitcoin market over the past several days. Break it down for us.
Well, if you just go back 2 years ago in January, this digital asset fetched about $3,600. By the beginning of this year, 2 years later, it would had gone up to $36,000, a tenfold increase.
Wow.
From the beginning of this year till last week, it went from $36,000 to $55,000. And now, as you noted, it is starting to slide some, but still, you know, look, this thing is up a dramatic 67% this year alone.
So talk to us then about Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's comments. She cautioned that Bitcoin was, quote, inefficient and that it takes enormous amounts of energy to complete transactions with it. What's behind that comment, do you think?
You know, there's sort of two different big inefficiencies. One is an actual climate inefficiency. In order to be awarded a Bitcoin, a huge supercomputer or network of computers has to solve a mathematical equation. Now, that takes energy. And when you talk about market inefficiencies, I think what she's saying is these ups and downs, this dramatic volatility can take investors on quite a ride. Now, that said, there are a lot of things that can take investors on for a ride. And I think that the regulatory regime in the United States and across the globe is going to have to deal with this idea of what are we going to do about Bitcoin? We are seeing more and more retail, ordinary investors get involved in this. So there's going to have to be some sort of cohesive policy that's created.
So do you think this latest slump, if you can call it that, it's all relative, right? And Janet Yellen's warnings could change the attitude around Bitcoin?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that we have a very interesting turn in the last few months. And that is that we have an institutional acceptance of Bitcoin. We have huge investment firms like BlackRock and MassMutual and Fidelity, as well as payment networks like MasterCard and PayPal and Square. And we have companies themselves like Tesla, which bought $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin back in January using 10% of its cash reserves. Mm. And that, to me, amounts to a real change, a sea change. Now, that said, I'm a complete wimp. And so if you're going to go out and invest in Bitcoin, I would just say this, be very careful. This is not for the faint of heart. Probably should be seen as a very small percentage of your invested assets.
Would you invest in Bitcoin?
I'm so dumb, honest to God. I mean, I started covering Bitcoin basically in 2013. It was trading for $13. I've never invested in Bitcoin. My producer did. He wrote it up, he wrote it down, and then as soon as he broke even, he sold it, and now he's kicking himself again.
That's Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, as always, thank you.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Since Vice President Kamala Harris took the oath as the country's first female vice president last month, members of the Southern Baptist Convention have made comments about her leadership, some referring to Harris as, quote, Jezebel. 2 days after Inauguration Day, Tom Buck, senior pastor at the First Baptist Church in Lyndale, Texas, tweeted this, quote, I can't imagine any truly God-fearing Israelite who would have wanted their daughters to view Jezebel as an inspirational role model because she was a woman in power, end quote. Despite criticism, Buck says he stands by those words. Tamora Lomax is the Foundational Associate Professor in the Department of African American and African Studies at Michigan State University and author of the book Jezebel Unhinged, Losing the Black Female Body in Religion and Culture. She joins us now on Skype. Welcome, Tamora. Nice to have you.
Glad to be here.
Well, you grew up attending church regularly. Your father was a Baptist preacher. In your book, you trace the use of the Jezebel trope in the black church and in black popular culture. What was your first thought when you heard that term being used to describe Vice President Kamala Harris?
Oh, man, I had so many thoughts. You know, the first, I guess, was a feeling, not so much a thought, and the feeling of being triggered, you know, is kind of this gaslighting that happens often to black women, you know, when these racialized stereotypes are utilized. So that was the first thing. And then the second thing, unfortunately, it was, of course, you know, I expected it. I've been following the Jezebel trope for over 16 years. And so it didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of my experiences of being a black girl, you know, who was raised in a Christian household, who was constantly being policed, but also being reconfigured in a very hypersexual way. And in the book, I talk about, you know, this, I think the first time me really realizing something is not right is that 11 years old, you know, I'm in church and there is a prominent member of the church who tells my father, who's a pastor, he could not focus during prayer because he was too focused on my 11-year-old derriere. And so instead of my parents becoming upset with the member, the church member, they had a talk with me, and it's what many Black parents do, you know, out of protection. And so I remember my parents giving me these rules saying you can't wear that dress again. You know, so I'm thinking the dress is the problem. So when it happened to Kamala, I said, oh, yes, of course. I expected this from them. Mm-hmm. I expected this trope to come about and to take on new life with the, you know, new vice president.
So remind us briefly who Jezebel was and the context of her story in scripture for those who may not be aware.
Yeah, so you have a couple things happening at once. You have the Jezebel stereotype, and then you have Jezebel, the biblical character. Jezebel, the biblical character, was a Phoenician princess from Tyre. She marries into a family. She marries a king, Ahab, who was king of northern Israel. And this is important because the king of northern Israel is expected, in the Christian Bible, is expected to yield to the Christian God. Well, Jezebel comes along, she marries Ahab, and she doesn't yield to the Christian God, the God of the Bible. Jezebel has her own God. So here she is foreign, right? So then there's the racialized issue there. So here she is, this princess marrying this king, now she's a queen, and she's saying, no, I'm not yielding to this, to your God, to the God of your people. I'm keeping my deities. So there you have this whole power dynamic where she and her, both her husband do not yield to the kind of gendered roles, you know, of the time. And so Jezebel becomes a very, very powerful queen. And this is what we have to think about when thinking about the stereotype. This still happens today in our society. When women have too much power, if they're too proud, they are immediately sexualized, right? So there's a power dynamic here.
So Jezebel had been saddled with a reputation as the sort of bad girl of the Bible, right? The wickedest of,
right,
of women. And so calling, yes, Vice President Kamala Harris a Jezebel, what, yes, does that signify to you?
It signifies that she's a bad woman. She's a foreign woman. She's not of us. She's not like us. We're not to respect her. She's misusing her power. She's in a position of power she should not be in. Those are the direct connections to the biblical Jezebel, right? But then you have the merging of that narrative of the evil foreign woman being connected to this racial stereotype that comes about long before the African slave women even reached the shores of America. My book goes back to the medieval period, and it looks at this hypersexual figure in Europe that's already in existence.
Yeah.
And what I argue in the text is that these ideas merge on the bodies of Black slave women. And so they are called, Black slave women are called Jezebel.
So I referenced Tom Buck's comments at the beginning, mm-hmm, but he's not the,
yeah,
only Baptist preacher to refer to Vice President Harris as a Jezebel. Weeks before the insurrection of January 6th, Steve Swofford, who's the head of the First Baptist Church of Rockwall near Dallas, made a similar statement during a sermon where he said, quote, "What if something happens to Biden and Jezebel has to take over?" End quote. And then he added, "Jezebel Harris? Isn't that her name?"
Oh, it's,
let me ask
so
you about
disgusting.
the clearly racist undertones here.
Yeah, it's really, it's such a disgusting thing. And it's, you know, it's the same pattern again and again and again. It's the same script again and again and again, right? That is to say that they are untrustworthy. They are a threat to society. And the one thing that we need to understand about the Southern Baptists is there's the racial issue, right? In terms of how the Southern Baptists even came about, it was they agreed with slavery and they broke off from the Baptists. So there's a belief that Black people are not equal to everyone else. So you have that. But then there is the gendered issue where they don't believe that women should have power over them, that women should not lead men. Here you have this woman who's in one of the highest offices of the land, of the world, ultimately. And so there's a fear about her being in this position, but then even more so about, you know, what happens if something happens to President Biden? The idea is that they're untrustworthy. They're a threat to society. So we need to get rid of them. And so this is a very dangerous territory, you know, that they're traveling. with the stereotype.
And it's interesting the context that we've seen this over and over again, right? The consistent sort of denigration of women politicians, and more specifically, women of color, from Ayanna Pressley, Ilhan Omar, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, now the vice president of the United States. Do you see this as just another blatant example of that?
Absolutely. It's in the same narrative. Like I said, it's the same script. You know, we saw it between years ago, you know, when Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. I mean, Anita Hill is someone who has the squeakiest clean, you know, representation and background. But yet here she was sexualized, right? She is the problem, not Clarence Hill. Just think about the questioning, you know, during this time. It's like, well, what did you do to provoke him? How are you dressed? You know, and she even talks about all the things that she had to do to really show that she was a good woman. She was not a bad woman. She was pure. She was respectable. She was morally upright, right? There was a lot of work done to show her as this good Christian woman. And that's a lot of work that other women do not have to do.
Tamora Lomax is the Foundational Associate Professor in the Department of African American and African Studies at Michigan State University and author of the book Jezebel Unhinged, Losing the Black Female Body in Religion and Culture. Tamora, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We reached out to Pastor Tom Buck and Steve Swofford. Neither gave us a comment, but J.D. Greer of the Southern Baptist Convention had this to say in a statement. Quote, some pastors are likely unaware of the history of certain racial stereotypes in calling or comparing our vice president to Jezebel, but that doesn't make such statements any less unwise. End quote.
If you're a plumber in the state of Texas, you are almost guaranteed to have more work than you can handle. In fact, demand is so high after last week's deadly winter freeze that plumbers are coming in from out of state to help repair all the busted pipes. Texas is even waiving the regulation that requires plumbers' apprentices to be directly supervised, and some residents are reporting price gouging when they see their repair bill. Johnny Rodriguez is lead plumber at Stan's Heating and Air in Austin. Johnny, welcome, and how busy have you been in the past couple of days?
Oh, we've been slammed. Every phone call we get, we try to book everybody, put them on the board. We know a lot of families don't have service, so we're trying to do what we can to get them service.
Well, and what kind of damage are you seeing when you go into people's homes? How bad is it?
Damages, bursted pipes, some of those pipes that are not protected properly, or even some that were protected. Just the cold front that came in, the elements just overwhelmed the pipes, drywall, masonry, I mean, you name it. A lot of houses got completely saturated.
Well, right. And what does that mean for people? I mean, are you talking about like an isolated pipe or two, or is this full house repairs?
We had one yesterday that had 17 different leaks in it. So we're talking about full house repipe now. Some of the homes got lucky, just had one burst. Move on to the next one. The next one after that would have four or five. Some of them we couldn't completely get, especially ones that had, you know, over five to six different bursts. We try to just get them services by capping off the line. As long as they had water to portion of the house, they were fine. So we go back a different date and go ahead and do the proper repairs.
How are people feeling when you come inside?
Oh, they are ecstatic to see us. They are so happy. We get the, as we're in the neighborhoods, we get people just walking by, driving by, honking at us, tell us thank you for working so hard. They just thank us like they're so glad to see us when we get there.
Glad to see you, but I know, I mean, the state of Texas is hurting right now. Could you just describe, I mean, because you have a front row seat to the devastation, could you describe the scale of the problem to your mind? I mean, the scale of the pain that people are feeling.
To be honest, I think the scale is high. It's up there about 8 and 9-ish. Yeah, families, again, were without heat, without water. Some of them have gone already a week without service to their homes. I guess a lot of people don't realize it, but something as simple as water to your home, once it gets cut off and you don't have any control over it, I mean, it kind of messes with you mentally. So a lot of the customers we have are just thankful that we're able to show up and get them service.
Yeah, thankful. But I'm sure there's also a concern about cost, because we all know that a bill from a plumber can add up even in normal times. And now there's a shortage of people who can do the work. What are rates like?
Well, it all depends on the repair. So it could be something as simple as going in, making one repair, that, of course, wouldn't be extremely high. But then it goes down to what else the house is going to need to get them up to service. So we just recommend to homeowners to go ahead and get a hold of their insurance company as they're waiting, and go ahead and get the someone to come out and take care of the water damages, and just be patient.
Well, all those repairs, they need materials, right? Have you seen shortages for things like copper piping, PVC, other stuff?
Yes, sir. Shortages. As soon as the thaw hit and we were able to hit the road, it seems like every plumber jumped to their closest supply house and started taking things off the shelves. We've even gone as far as going out of town to grab materials just to keep us going for a couple days. And everything's that we're ordering is pretty much back ordered, or we're waiting for materials to come in.
What does that mean for prices and for getting the job done in a timely way?
Well, all we can do is regain service to the home, and that goes with whatever it takes, whatever's necessary for them to have service. As long as we install a approved material, then we will come back when we do have the proper supplies and reinstall and repair what we need to.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you saw Governor Greg Abbott has waived certain regulations for plumbers that will allow out-of-state plumbers to come in and work in Texas, and would also allow apprentices to work without direct supervision. What do you think about that? Does that sort of policy need to be in place, or does it worry you that some of the work might not be done as well as it would be otherwise?
It kind of worries me, not more for the plumbers who are licensed that are coming out of state. We're thankful that they can come out and give us a hand. It's more of the apprentices. The apprentice needs to have his time in the field in order for him to gain his knowledge and to go out and service homes properly. So I would advise the homeowners to ask the person, the technician who's out in the field, let me see your license. If the apprentice has an apprentice card, which is a red card, I would recommend them to ask for someone else that has either a green one or a blue one, or a master's card, which is a gold one.
So judging by what you've seen on the ground there in Austin, how long do you think it'll take before most of the homes are repaired and your level of business goes back down to normal?
Oh, we're looking to about after April.
Wow. You must be tired.
Yes, sir. We're doing well over 80 calls a day, so we are exhausted.
Johnny Rodriguez, lead plumber at Stans Heating and Air in Austin, Texas. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us, since you do have so much to do out there. We appreciate it. Good luck.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now.